is Our American Stories, and one of our favorite shows on television is Shark Tank, and for so many good reasons. What's most interesting about Shark Tank is the sharks, those are the guys and gals worth a lot of money, all of them started with nothing, and now they have net worths of in the hundreds of millions, and in one case, Mark Cuban, over $1 billion. But again, just a generation before, none of them born to wealth, all of them self-made men and women. An African-American, a woman, two men, three men, a woman, sometimes two women, two men. Just depends on the setup. They have some rotating panelists. And then up come people to pitch the sharks so they can get some of that shark money. And just as important, they can get some of that shark experience and wisdom. And so it's really teaching folks about why wealth needs to stay with the wealthy. It can go to the government and high taxes, or it can stay in the marketplace and go to American dreamers who are one day hoping to build wealth themselves, and by the way, build businesses and employ people. And in this particular week, up next in the tank was an 18-year-old kid who discovered an unusual passion that he's looking to make some money on.
I discovered my passion for maple syrup when I was 11 years old. I was captivated by the idea that I could go to my own backyard, tap the trees, and make my own delicious maple syrup. When I was 15, I decided I wanted to turn it into a real business. I knew that that meant more equipment and more money, and so I was fortunate enough that my dad was willing to co-sign a bank loan and lend me $70,000 of his own money.
If you don't know your numbers, you will not know your business.
I've reached a point where I'm getting interest from big retailers, and I need a Shark's investment to help me take that next step. I've chosen to take this path. All of my friends have gone to college. I've chosen to run a maple syrup business. Everything in my future is dependent on this working.
Wow, not all is lost on this generation, folks. Who is this kid? And what does he want from the sharks?
Hi, sharks. My name is Joshua Parker. I'm from Canton, New York. My company is Parker Maple, and I'm seeking $200,000 for a 20% stake in my company. When I was 11 years old, I went on a school field trip to learn how maple syrup is made. Where I expected to find a fun afternoon, I found something else entirely. I found a passion for making maple syrup. 4 years later, I decided to turn my passion into a real business, and today, Parker Maple is one of the fastest growing and most innovative maple syrup companies in the country. Parker Maple offers an entire line of maple products, from maple syrup to maple cotton candy, and today, I am working to successfully bring a unique maple product into the national space, maple butter, a delicious, creamy and natural spread, perfect for toast, icing, fruit, and just about anything else. Sharks, I have proven that the American dream is not dead, that people in my generation can succeed. We will be America's brand for real maple.
Wow, be still my heart. By the way, Alex, $200,000, 20%. What's he valuing his company at?
$1 million.
$1 million. And by the way, this is really good. I love now that generations of people understand things like valuation of businesses. It's terrific. So the next time you hear someone say that today's kids are lazy, think of Joshua Parker. And from the sound of things, the sharks are eating it up.
Tell us what we're eating here. This is the maple butter here.
So the maple butter is on the English muffin.
Oh, wow. Oh, my God.
I love it.
The spread is really good.
Thank you very much.
Cotton candy really good. Is out of this world.
And here's Joshua's sales numbers.
To date, we've done just about $360,000 in sales since the beginning of the company.
Well, how about this year?
By the year's end, we'll break $1.5 million in sales.
Wow.
Wow.
Yes.
Impressive. By the way, you don't hear wow that often on Shark Tank. Barbara has some issues with Joshua's valuation of $1 million, though. Will she be in or out?
Can I return to the spectacular figure, $1.5 million in sales by year end?
Yes.
I wasn't quite sure I was clear as to how you were going to get there.
That's based on getting into 75 to 100 clubs with Costco.
But you don't have those orders nor commitments.
Right.
So that's a projection based on optimism.
Right. Yes.
I've sold product into Costco, but I don't find that they order the additional store so quickly.
Right.
They really want to see how well it does. I think it's going to take you a number of years. I think you're optimistic about what your sales are going to be. I just don't think you're going to make the kind of money, and I don't think I'd get my money back out, so I'm out.
Oof. What about Mark Cuban? He has an issue with packaging and price point for the maple cotton candy. In or out?
This is only 114 calories.
Yes.
Whenever you have something this big, that tastes this good.
It's only 114 calories.
Wow. Yes.
That only has 114 calories. You should say across the whole thing.
Yes.
Only 114 calories.
Yeah. Yeah.
How much does it cost?
72 cents.
And what do you sell it for?
$1.50.
No, you're selling it for $2.99 now.
Okay.
This will be your best seller. But in order to be investable, you're going to have to scale to enormous size. And I just don't see you doing that right now. I'm out.
Robert is also skeptical about this kid's optimistic valuation. In or out?
I think your forecast is really optimistic based on your own story. I don't know if it's going to happen, but you've got a long way to go. Just not a space that I want to be in right now. I'm out.
And Lori has some kind words for our young entrepreneur, but will kind words be enough to get a deal?
You are a dynamo. You are going to make things happen no matter what happens. I love your product, but I don't see it as an investment for me because your margins are so very low.
Right.
For that reason, I'm out, but I can see you making it.
Mr. Wonderful has a little story to tell about his extensive background with maple products.
Before I was known as Mr. Wonderful, I lived and went to school right on the border of Vermont and Quebec.
Oh, really?
It was a military college. I became a marksman there, but I was also known as Maple Man.
Really?
Because I love maple syrup. No question about it.
That's a cute story from Mr. Wonderful, I mean Mr. Maple. But will it be enough to get this kid a deal?
The problem here, Josh, is $200,000 for 20% imputes $1 million valuation. But you're not actually profitable yet. So for any investor, I wouldn't do this for 20%. It would be a huge amount of equity. And you're a family business. I don't see any way to do a deal that's going to make sense and be of benefit to both of us. Maple Man is out.
Ouch. While Joshua didn't score a deal, he got some great exposure just by being on Shark Tank. And he's not letting it get him down.
I think that in the tank today, I learned more than a semester in college. I'm going to go home. I'm going to make the changes that I think that are right for the company and really take their advice.
Well, was he adorable, that kid,
adorable.
Right?
Adorable.
This is better than cotton candy.
It's amazing. Put that cotton candy in my trailer.
And that's why we love Shark Tank. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More after these messages.
Why don't you pay attention? What kind of responsible behavior is that? There is no excuse for that. Just do me a favor. Step yourself outside. You're irritating me.
Well, I'm back inside, and so is our whole crew for our favorite segment.
Yeah.
That's our Judge Judy Roundup. And by the way, the story of Judge Judy is remarkable. 60 Minutes went into her courtroom, her family courtroom, somewhere in New York City, one of the boroughs. It was a legendary courtroom where people would go in just to be entertained by her presence. And I mean, it was standing room only. And so in come the cameras from 60 Minutes, and somebody in Hollywood must have seen that and went, that lady should have herself a show. Highest paid personality in television year in, year out. The show is on hours a day all over this country. And we like to bring you our favorite segments from time to time because a lot of you are working when it's on, and it's not the kind of thing you necessarily TiVo, but it is the kind of thing when you're around and it's on, I dare you to turn it off once you start watching one of those cases. And so Judge Judy, who, by the way, her first book, what was it called, Jesse? Stop.
Don't pee on my leg and tell me it's raining.
Don't pee on my leg and tell me it's raining.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, Judge Judy. A little plug for your book. We'll take 10%. And let's talk about the latest. It's this week's case of the teenage roommates. Let's take a listen.
Who are the three roommates? Raise your paws. Very good. Miss Davey, according to your complaint, you, this young lady, and this young lady decided to lease an apartment together. You signed the lease for how long?
Till August 10th. 6 months.
And you were going to share the rent?
Yes, we were going to split it three ways equally.
Your complaint alleges that Miss Hansen did not pay her rent for February and did not pay her rent in March.
Right.
And then you did what?
She called me one night asking to get into the house, and I was busy. I wasn't at home, so I didn't let her in. And I told her that I wasn't going to let her back into the house until she paid me the money that she owed me.
So you locked her out?
Well, she was locked out. I didn't try to intentionally lock her out.
Why didn't you go to a locksmith and make a third key? I don't understand that. How?
I don't know. We could have done that, but didn't.
Anyway,
so we didn't have the three keys.
You locked her out. You locked her out, and now you want your rent.
Yeah, she owes me for 2 months of rent.
Okay.
So, and this is why Judge Judy's so good. She somehow has that ability to find out what the real story is. She's like a great, great examiner. So she didn't intend to lock her out, but now she admits she did. Let's find out more about these three roommates.
How old are you?
I'm 19.
Was that a question or an answer?
An answer.
And what do you do for a living?
I waitress and cook at the World Cafe.
And what do you do, Miss Anson?
I work at a coffee shop.
And you?
I'm front desk clerk at the Holiday Inn.
How old are you?
19.
You moved out when in March?
The very first week of March.
Why didn't you pay March's rent?
Because the rent was due on the 6th, and I told her that I couldn't give her March rent until that weekend. Because
why?
Because my mom was giving me money for it, because I didn't have a job at the time. And my mom
got paid. Why did you move into an apartment if you didn't have a job?
Because they needed me to be on the lease to get the apartment.
Well, they didn't. Listen to me, Miss Hanson. They don't need an unemployed teenager to sign on the lease. Listen to me carefully. They don't need an unemployed teenager to sign on a lease in order for a landlord to say, oh, now they're really responsible because we have three teenagers, only one of whom has a job, maybe. That's not why they needed you to sign on, unless you had a job.
No, not the leasing company needed me to sign on. Taylor needed me to sign on the lease so she could get the apartment because Brittany couldn't get a co-signer, and I got a co-signer.
Who co-signed for you?
My mom.
Oh,
that's
great. Perfect.
I wouldn't have been able to get on the lease without a co-signer.
But she forged the co-signer.
That's
so
not true
just
at all.
Just shh. Cute. They should still be home and under somebody else's roof, but they're cute.
They're cute. So let's get back to the case.
Listen, you have to pay rent. You live in an apartment, you have to pay rent.
I totally agree.
Right, so you owe February and March's rent.
I didn't live there for March. She kicked me out at the beginning of March.
No, you lived there the first week in March.
Then I would have paid her the first week of March, that, like, day by day that I lived there, but they kicked me out of my house.
No, listen to me. I'm going to get to your counterclaim in a second.
Okay.
You may not be disappointed, but I have to explain to you that when you live in an apartment, you can't be a baby. And if you sign a lease and if you're supposed to pay rent, you say the first of the month you have to pay rent. And you don't take on the responsibility of an apartment unless you can afford it. Are you still living in the apartment?
Yes, I am.
Who lives there?
I found two roommates on Craigslist.
Are they okay?
Yeah, they're great.
And what was everybody's share of the rent?
$250 each.
Okay.
Let's go to the judge and the counterclaim.
Now, you're going to tell me about your clothes.
Well, the day that they locked me out, told me that I couldn't come back.
Should have had your own key.
I had my own key. I let Brittany use it.
That's
she
your
didn't
problem.
Have her own key.
No, that's your problem.
Okay.
You should have had your own key. Then nobody can lock you out.
Yeah, but that day that they locked me out, they told me that they were kicking me out. I couldn't live
there anymore. Well, they could have told you that, but that's not true. They can't kick you out because you're on the lease.
Well, I didn't want to live there anymore after that anyway, because they were
rude to you.
Yeah, and they were bullying me.
Okay.
So I went the next day to get my things, and I had to get a key from the leasing office, and my room had been gone through. Half of my closet was empty. I asked them for my things back. They had put locks on their doors, and they wouldn't give me anything back and said that they didn't have anything. A couple weeks later, a friend of mine was showing me Brittany's MySpace pictures, and she was wearing my underwear on on a photo of her topless and just in underwear, and they were mine.
You recognize your underpants?
Yeah.
You recognize your underpants?
They're like specialty kind. They're not just like regular white underwear. They're like, you can buy them from like a boutique.
Outrageous.
Outrageous is right. I love that Judge Judy hones in on that because we're all thinking the same thing.
That's baloney.
Exactly.
It doesn't make sense.
So the judge presses in on the underwear issue.
Miss Davey, just for my own edification, did you put a picture of yourself?
Oh, me? No. I don't do that.
Who did? This one.
Brittany.
Raise your hand if you put up a naked picture of yourself.
I'm not naked.
in the picture.
What is it?
I'm in underwear. They're my underwear. They're not her underwear. I don't know why she.
Why would you put stand up?
Why would she put underwear?
Please. Why would you put a picture of yourself on the internet in your underwear?
One of my friends did it for his photography thing. He wanted American Apparel looking pictures, and there was one in my underwear.
Very stupid.
Okay.
You live to regret that when you're 30, maybe even when you're 25. Have you done anything like that again?
No.
Yes. Before?
No.
Maybe. No. Just once?
No, well, like, there was more than one picture, but
something.
It's not that big of a deal, I don't think.
It is a big deal. You have to think about what you're doing. There are all kinds of perverts and creepy people out there that sort of surf the internet looking for dumb young girls who put up pictures of themselves in their underwear, or worse. Don't do it again.
Okay.
Sit down.
Ah, that's why we love Judge Judy. Back to the judge and her closing remarks in this case.
Do you have any other proof that she took your clothes?
I don't really have proof that they took my clothes, but I have a list of some of the clothes that they took, and along with stealing my clothes, they posted things about me on the internet. Like, they made a couple websites about me saying really, really horrible things. They've been harassing me. It's just showing what kind of people they are. They're not good girls. They're not good people. And they stole all my clothing, locked me out of my house, and are harassing me for it.
No, I don't.
I don't know whether she does or whether she doesn't.
I have a pair of Roxy jeans and a pair of Gap jeans that were given to me by her because they were a size 5, which doesn't fit her.
That's not true. I never gave her any clothes.
She wants them back.
She can have them.
They've been denying that they've had anything this
I long. Haven't been
listen
any
to
contact.
Me. I have no time or to have less patience for this. You owe her $500 for rent for February and March. You're going to send her back her 2 pairs of jeans and anything else you might find that belongs to her. Do you get it?
I do.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank
Goodbye.
You.
Bye. Have a happy life.
Oh, what a classic. Bye. Have a happy life. I don't think Judge Judy holds out much hope for a couple of these girls, and maybe some more adult supervision is in order. Here's the girl's closing remarks.
Parties are excused. You may step out.
I moved out. I wasn't agreeing with the way that they were living.
They have lived a lifestyle that maybe she wasn't happy with.
The constant partying, the drinking, the drugs.
I do like to party sometimes.
The stripping, all sorts of things.
But I thought she was in on the whole thing.
They just weren't good girls anymore.
And there you have it. Just stripping and this or that. And Judge Judy knew this. Is this the first time? Yeah. I mean, Judge Judy knows this wasn't the first time. And this girl just doesn't care. And there are no adults telling her that it might not be a good idea to post pictures of yourself in your underwear on the internet. And this is why we love Judge Judy. You know, a lot of people say, don't judge. Don't judge people. Well, this is why Judge Judy loves him and why we love Judge Judy and so many, even kids, listen and watch to Judge Judy. She judges a lot and she lets it rip. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, our favorite show, along with Shark Tank. We bring it to you every week, both of them, on Our American Stories.
Yes! No! No, 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 no. Let's hear it. Yes! No, no, no.
This is Our American Stories, where we love great stories about music, sports, love, death, and business. But one of our favorite subjects is generosity and the generous things Americans do for each other and the world. Which brings us to our sweet charity series with our partners, the Philanthropy Roundtable, the nation's leader in fostering excellence and generosity, protecting philanthropic freedom, and assisting givers in achieving their goals. And the host of the series is none other than Carl Zinsmeister, their head of publications, and a guy as eclectic as the stories you'll hear in this series. He's authored 11 books, including the terrific Almanac of American Philanthropy, which you should pick up and read with your family. And Carl lives in a houseboat. We'll have to. That's a whole segment, by the way. We're going to have to talk to Carl about that. But take it away, Carl.
Many of us can remember learning, maybe back in our high school years, about the great telescopes with which astronomers have made crucial discoveries about our universe and the nature of our physical world. Mount Palomar, Mount Wilson, the Lick and Yerkes and Keck telescopes, these are familiar icons of science. What you may not have been taught is that all of these magnificent science-transforming instruments were filled with light by philanthropy. Donors created the Lick and Yerkes observatories before the 20th century. Then Andrew Carnegie's money placed 60-inch and later 100-inch reflecting telescopes on Mount Wilson. It was Rockefeller funding that erected the 200-inch Hale telescope on Mount Palomar. More recently, the Keck Foundation made possible the pair of 33-foot reflectors that opened in 1993 on a Hawaiian mountaintop. And the two massive instruments under construction today, the Giant Magellan Telescope and the 30-meter telescope, are both being built with donations. And I mean big donations, like the $250 million slapped down to design the 30-meter instrument by Gordon Moore. Co-founder of the Intel Corporation, Moore has devoted close to $1 billion to science philanthropy in recent years. These new super telescopes will have light-collecting mirrors measuring close to 100 feet across. That's a bigger footprint than a large house. To get a sense of some of the engineering challenges that must be overcome in order to build a precise instrument that large, listen to Wendy Friedman, the chair of the Magellan Project, discussing the demands in a documentary film clip.
Each of these mirrors, the glass alone is 20 tons of glass in each mirror. There are seven of the mirrors. There's a mount made of steel that has to hold the mirrors, the structure, the instruments, the top end of the telescope where there are secondary mirrors. We have to measure the distance between the primary mirror and the secondary mirror to one part in 500 million. And then focus light to a fraction of a wavelength of light. It's an astonishing challenge. And this enclosure will be the height of a 22-story building. It's not an ordinary building. It has to rotate so that you can point the telescope in the sky and look out and see distant objects.
In addition to being larger than existing telescopes by a whole order of magnitude, these new eyes on the sky will feature so-called adaptive optics. They'll use lasers and tiny electric motors to make constant, minute adjustments in the shape of the mirror to counteract turbulence in the Earth's atmosphere that bends light. Amazingly, these adjustments will result in images as sharp as those taken in space, where there's no atmosphere to distort incoming light. These instruments will each cost more than $1 billion. Just as Gordon Moore put up two huge gifts to get the 30-meter telescope designed, the Giant Magellan Telescope was also launched by financial angels. George Mitchell, father of the oil and gas fracking process and a major donor to science, was an early heavy backer of the Magellan. Other donors provided hundreds of millions of dollars on their own, and thanks to their faith in astronomical exploration, the Giant Magellan will be the first of these two donor-funded telescopes to open its eyes. That will happen about 6 years from now. And once they go to work, these potent machines will produce images 12 times sharper than NASA's Hubble telescope, the current state of the art. Revolutionary effects on fundamental physics and our understanding of the universe will almost immediately begin to flow from these fruits of philanthropy.
And thanks, as always, Carl. And it never ceases to amaze the tentacles of philanthropy, what it delves into, what it backs, the things that it influences in this country from science to the arts, and straight through to, of course, the obvious, and that is feeding the poor, housing the poor. And again, Carl Zinsmeister, always doing great work at the Philanthropy Roundtable, and his great publication, The Almanac of American Philanthropy. Pick it up where you can. Amazon.com has it. And now we wanted to take you to a story from CBS that happened recently. There are always a lot of people to thank on a wedding day, but the bride-to-be at a church outside Chicago had one person to thank over all others, a total stranger who made it possible. Here's Steve Hartman with his report from CBS on the road in Frankfort, Illinois.
There are always a lot of people to thank on a wedding day.
But the bride-to-be at this church outside Chicago had one person to thank over all others, a total stranger who made this possible.
I wouldn't have been here if it wasn't for him.
A couple years ago, out of the blue, 27-year-old Heather Krueger was diagnosed with stage 4 liver disease. Doctors said she had just a few months to live.
I mean, they immediately told me I was going to need a transplant.
That's not enough time to really find a donor, right?
No. By that time, I could really feel my body shutting down.
Enter our hero. Chris Dempsey is a code enforcement officer for the village of Frankfort, Illinois.
What's going on?
And he says he was in the break room one day when he overheard a guy talking about this woman who needed a liver donor.
I spent 4 years in the Marine Corps and learned there never to run away from anything. So I just said to myself, hey, if I can help, I'm going to help.
Keep in mind, he'd never met Heather, but he got tested to see if he was compatible. And when he found out he was, that's when they finally met for the first time.
We had lunch together, discussed what the whole process was going to be.
Did you buy at least?
No, he bought.
Oh my gosh, this guy's amazing.
Yeah, he bought, but I remember.
Not long after, they checked into the University of Illinois Hospital. The transplant, which involves removing about half of the donor's liver, went off without a hitch. Afterward, Chris and Heather remained close. They got so close, in fact, he was at her wedding last weekend. He had to be, really. I mean, what's a wedding without a groom? And so it was that a year and a half after giving her part of his liver, she gave him all her heart.
You're the most incredible man I've ever known. You believe in me, and you make me feel amazing every single day. Because of you, I laugh, smile, and I dare to dream again.
Acts of great kindness are done without expectation. When Chris decided to give an organ to a random stranger, he had no idea he was saving his own wife. But such is the way of goodness. The more likely you are to live for others, the more likely you are to live happily ever after. Steve Hartman on the road in Frankfort, Illinois.
Man, what a story. That may have been the best we've heard here so far. You can't make that stuff up, folks. And this is why we love Sunday morning, CBS Sunday morning. And it's one of the best shows in television. And it's precisely because they don't hit you over the head for an hour. For at least an hour, you can smile, enjoy your breakfast, watch the kids, watch the show, and smile. Thanks to Hartman for that work, and Steve does great work over there. This is Our American Stories, and you can go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to capture all that we do. We try and do the same things that they do over there. Tell stories, no screaming, no yelling, no cynicism, none at all here. Again, this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. This is Our American Stories. You're listening to Eddie Vedder, lamenting the day, celebrating the day that one day the Cubbies will go all the way. And maybe it'll happen. This could be the year. And joining us, as always, for our weekly sports roundup is our friend from For the Win, and that's ftw.usatoday.com. And thanks so much, as always, for joining us, Nate Scott.
Hey, Lee, how you doing?
And what do you think about the fact that Pearl Jam has to write a song about the fact that one day the Cubs just might win? Is that just sad to you or pathetic or just interesting and funny?
It's great. Eddie Vedder, I think he thought he'd get probably another 100 years out of that song. But you know what? A few years we'll have to do, and I think he'll trade it for the song not really being relevant anymore for the team winning a World Series.
I think so. I think he would trade that. I think that was written from the heart. And he and George Will actually might agree on something. Isn't that a strange pair? watching them have a beer together would really be something, Nate. I think you'd have to cover that.
Yeah, that would be fantastic.
Hey, let's talk a little bit about the actual series. Talk about these two teams just a little bit. And I think America's interest. Do you think this is going to pull in the ratings because these two underdogs are playing?
I do. I think this is, we've got the Chicago Cubs and the Cleveland Indians. Neither has won a World Series since 1945, I believe. Cubs haven't been to the, or 1948. Cubs haven't been, won a pennant since 1945. They haven't won a World Series since 1908. So it's a great World Series, you know. Not the biggest metropolises, I guess, not the biggest TV markets, but everyone's going to be tuning in because we're going to see history be made one way or the other, and this is going to be a really fun one.
You know, and I think, Nate, what's interesting to me is, look, you had Golden State Warriors, not the biggest media market. You had the San Antonio Spurs, but you've had great basketball. And most Americans come from small towns. Even the ones that moved to big cities came from small towns. And I think the bias over the years has been that, wow, if you don't have big city markets, people aren't going to tune in. But I haven't tuned in because it's big city markets. I think most of us tune in because it's great sports and great stories and great stars. What's your thought on that?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. You know, we live in the internet age. There's no shortage of information. It's not like if you don't live in Chicago, you can't follow along with the Cubs anymore. You can follow them very easily. They're on TV all the time. You can watch streaming games. So no matter where you are, you can follow these teams. And for a team like the Cubs, who have maybe the most likable group of young players assembled in a major league team in, years, they're a hard team to not root for. You want to pull for them, and I think this World Series is going to do huge ratings.
Yeah, I do too. And Bill Murray had quite a reaction. Talk about Bill Murray, the actor, of course, another lifetime Cubs fan. Talk about his reaction to the Cubs making it to the World Series, Nate.
Well, it's wonderful. He was, the cameras caught him in the crowd just bursting into tears, and it looked like really sincere tears. He was just, I guess, built up for so long, and he let it go. And I think he was also crying out of happiness because he was given the Mark Twain Comedy Award in Washington, D.C. the next night, which would have been Game 7 had the Cubs not clinched. And he was going to have to choose whether or not to go to Game 7 or go to this major award in his honor. And because the Cubs pulled it out in 6, he didn't have to go. So I think he was pretty excited about that.
Yeah, that might have made him cry, too. But by the way, that would have been one tough choice for a lifetime Cubs fans. I don't know. I think Murray might have actually recorded something really funny and maybe broadcast live from the Cubs, from Wrigley.
Yeah, seriously. Just brought his iPhone in the crowd and just FaceTimed it from the sixth row. Just whatever. It doesn't matter.
It wouldn't have mattered, and I think it would have brought the house down, Nate. It would have brought the house down in classic Murray fashion. Hey, we have a short clip, by the way, of Bill Murray crashing the White House press briefing and talking about the weather differences between Chicago and Los Angeles, the home of the Dodgers, who the Cubs just beat. Let's take a quick listen, Nate.
We also can get a little bit of autumn in Chicago. You don't get that in Los Angeles. Trees just die in Los Angeles. In Illinois, they flourish. They perform. They should go.
Well, you know, leave it to Bill Murray to take over a White House press conference and have some fun. But it's more than celebrity. What do you pick as the team that'll dominate? How are you folks at For the Win looking at things in this series? What's your handicapping?
I'm picking the Cubs in 5. I think, as Bill Murray said in that same White House press conference, they got too many sticks. They got too many bats. Their hitting is too good. It looks like Kyle Schwarber, who was their big mashing power hitter, who was injured in the third game of the season. He sat out the entire season. It looks like he's going to be back to play DH. And I just, you know, the Indians have a lot of injuries to their starting rotation with pitchers, and they have a great bullpen, but I just don't see them getting ahead in games and letting the bullpen take over. So I'm picking the Cubs in 5.
Yeah, I'm with you, Nate. I'm taking the Cubbies in 6. So that's not interesting radio, but I think we both see things the same. Hey, I wanted to share with you. Last year, we did a whole hour on the Chicago Cubs and their whirlwind of a story when they made the playoffs. And one of our favorite clips was from a Chicago White Sox fan named Paul Miller on being told that he has to cheer for the crosstown rival, the Cubs, because the Sox aren't in the playoffs. Take a listen to this, Nate, and get your reaction.
It's the argument that my mother makes. Well, you want to root for Chicago. It's like, you know, I do root for Chicago. I root for the Sox, the Hawks, the Bulls, the Bears. I even root for the Wolves. I go to Wolves games, which is the minor league hockey team. I don't need to root for the Cubs. To me, the Cubs also, to me, aren't, they're not very Chicago. That's another thing to me. Now, even though, of course, they're aligned with the city, to me, the White Sox always define that blue-collar, working-class, South Side ethnic, culture that is really Chicago. Cubs are a bunch of yuppies. It's a bunch of yuppies, college kids who finally get their first job or they move into the neighborhood, people that, go for the game for a few innings and they go bar hopping, a tourist trap. That's what the Cubs attract. To me, and a bunch of suburban schmucks.
A bunch of suburban schmucks. What do you think
brutal
of that,
analysis
Nate? Tell me how you feel.
That's fantastic.
And that's what we love about sports in the end, these loyalties between teams, amongst teams, which brings us to the NFL. Nate, what's going on? The ratings have plunged. Everybody's got a theory. What's yours?
I think the election has something to do with it. I think that it's harder and harder to measure TV ratings than ever before because people watch on all sort of different devices. The biggest thing, though, I think, is that the NFL has given us too much. It's diluting the product. NFL used to be Sundays and Monday night football, and now we've got Thursday night games, and now we've got an endless off-season stories, and now we've got Sunday morning games played in England. So you have to wake up if you're on the West Coast, you got to wake up at 6:30 in the morning to watch an NFL game. It's too much. It's diluting the product. The players are all exhausted because of these ridiculous schedules. The Thursday night games are awful. Last night was played Sunday night when we're recording this, maybe the worst NFL game in history, a 6-6 tie that saw a bunch of missed field goals. At a certain point, you keep having these players play and you keep loading up the schedule. The quality is going to suffer, and I think we're seeing that now.
Yeah, and I mean, how many hours do they think we have to watch anyway? I mean, I know women are watching and it's the fastest growing demographic, but I think men still have to fight for some of that time. And my goodness, a few hours on Sunday, 4 or 5, okay. Then it's Sunday night, then it's Monday night. And the next thing you got a shotgun aimed at your head. This is not good. So you're right about the extension of the product, Nate. But what about also the fact that maybe some of the franchise players and teams are not quite what they used to be? And maybe just as the NBA has its ups and downs as it turns to its stars, does the NFL lose something when they lose a Peyton Manning and a Brett Favre? Do they have people who replace those guys yet? How much of that plays into this?
I think that's definitely it. I think the other thing is the way that the NFL salary cap is structured, the players that you most want to have are rookies because they're on the cheapest deals. They come out of college. They're signed to really team-friendly deals. And so once a guy gets on his second and third contract, a lot of teams will just cut him. And what that means is there's no continuity. We don't know who any of these players are because every season they just keep cycling in these 22-year-olds. And I think the play suffers because of that as well. A lot of NFL coaches have talked about it. They said, we've got these super athletic, really eager kids, and none of them know how to play football. And it hurts as fans because we don't recognize anyone on the field. And if a running back come into the league in a year and they're gone, and so you're just hanging on to those few quarterbacks. And, when Tom Brady and Drew Brees leave the league, I don't know who it's going to be. It'll be Andrew Luck and Russell Wilson, I guess. But yep. I don't know if that's enough to sustain the NFL.
No, it's not. It's no fun to go to a game and not know any of the players, or at least not know key positions. And all these things, I think, are converging on the NFL, and they better get to fixing it. And, of course, Nate, just really quickly, what impact does all this high-level college football have? This, ESPN's coming at you on Saturday night, ABC, CBS, the SEC, the Pac-10. I mean, college football's going in there and competing for eyeballs too.
And that's the thing, you know, the thing with the NFL, to bring it back to the last point, was you knew the players. They were there for years and years and years. College was a little harder because if you weren't from an area, the players keep changing over and over again. Now the NFL's the exact same way, and the college game's more fun, and yep. The atmosphere is more fun, so why not watch it?
And why not watch it is right. Nate, we're both rooting for the Cubs. Let's see what happens. We look forward to talking to you next week. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, our weekly sports segment with Nate Scott. FDW.USAtoday.com. That's for the win. Again, FDW.USAtoday.com. More after these messages. This is Our American Stories, and now we're going to spend the hour on the life of Jackie Robinson. He died on this day in history. The first African American to play Major League Baseball, his greatest impact was not on the field, but on the status of Black Americans and helping white America see them as equal human beings. And of course, after Jackie, how could they not? Here was a Black man, right before their eyes, winning Major League Baseball's Rookie of the Year and the World Series in 1955 in a league filled with white men. For the next hour, we'll celebrate his life. We'll hear from everybody, Branch Rickey, Harrison Ford, Pee Wee Reese. But the man shepherding this is Pat Williams, the co-founder and senior vice president of the Orlando Magic. Pat has written over 80 books on leadership, has run over 58 marathons, has 19 children, 14 of which were adopted. I hate you, Pat. Pat, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Lee, how you doing? Nice to talk to you tonight.
You betcha. You know, you wrote a remarkable book, which, by the way, I'll implore everybody listening to this to read, How to Be Like Jackie Robinson. And, well, you interviewed a whole lot of folks to do this. 1,100, Pat. Talk about that.
Well, I got carried away, I guess, Lee. I got really fascinated with all the different people who might have a story about Jackie Robinson, so I tracked down every ball player from that era, from 46, 47, you know, for the next decade, who would have played against Jackie or played with him, and I wanted to get to them. Then, of course, you know, there were still many media members to get to, baseball executives, many different fields that Jackie was in. So over a course of 3 years, I tracked down all of those people, and we wove all that together in this book called How to Be Like Jackie Robinson.
Well, tell me this. You spoke to one person, the chairman emeritus of Major League Baseball, Bud Selig. And, you know, if you could, share what you wrote or what he said to you and what you wrote in the foreword in your book, Pat.
Well, it was a wonderful foreword that Bud Selig did. He was then the commissioner of baseball. First of all, he talked about, as a youngster growing up in Milwaukee, going down to Wrigley Field in 1947 when the Dodgers came in to play the Cubs. And he talked about the fact that he and his friend, Herb Cole, were among the very few white people in the ballpark, and how that made them feel, and how proud they were looking back to have been there to see Jackie Robinson play. And then Bud said, I understand that, you know, if you, you know, go through 20 books and maybe talk to 200 people, you've researched thoroughly, but Williams has gone through hundreds of books and over 1,000 interviews, so this is packed with information. That was the gist of what Commissioner Selig wrote. I felt very, very honored that he did that.
Let me tell you, we're going to play a clip, and we're going to be playing clips throughout this hour. I was going through some of the files of Hall of Fame speeches, and I stumbled upon Henry Aaron's. And Henry Aaron had his own crucible to deal with, playing at the Atlanta Braves during some tough times himself. But here's what Hank had to say about the impact Jackie Robinson had on his young life.
I also feel especially proud to be standing here where some years ago, Jackie Robinson and Roy Campanella proved the way and made it possible for Frank and me and for other blacks hopeful in baseball. They proved to the world that a man's ability is limited only by his lack of opportunity.
That's beautiful. Pat, you write in your book, after a conversation with Martin Luther King Jr., Jackie had with four, that you or Don Newcomb had had with Martin Luther King. And well, Don Newcomb was the former, just for the fans and folks listening, he was the Dodger pitcher. And the impact that Robinson had on Martin Luther King. Talk about that.
Well, Martin Luther King ran into those ball players, those black Dodger ball players, and he went out of his way to tell them that they paved the way for him. Keep in mind, Jackie Robinson broke into the big leagues in 1947. That was long before Dr. King started his crusade. You know, he came along maybe a decade later and beyond. So he went out of his way to tell those ball players how important it was what they did and what an inspiration they were to Dr. King.
You know, I wanted to read, if I could, Pat, you wrote the following. Martin Luther King Jr. once said Jackie was more important to the movement than he was. One night in 1968, you wrote, only a month or so before James Earl Ray murdered him, King was having dinner with former Dodgers pitcher Don Newcomb, and King said he appreciated how much easier Robinson, Newcomb, and Roy Campanella had made his job by excelling on the baseball field. All those moments when King had to stand up for equal rights alone, all of those times when he was sprayed with water hoses, clubbed with nightsticks, and even sent to jail, and Newcomb couldn't believe what he was hearing. We made it easier for him. How did that make you feel, even being able to report that to the American people? I don't think folks had ever heard a story like that about MLK.
Oh, I was, listen, when I heard the story, I lumped up and had tears in my eyes to hear Dr. King explaining to those ballplayers just how important they had been to his life and his career. It was a wonderful tribute, I thought, and I felt very good about baseball and sports and all that it contributes to American society.
When we come back, we're going to be talking about Jackie Robinson's faith. It's interesting they call Martin Luther King Jr. Doctor, but we know he's a reverend, a man of the cloth. The peaceful resistance that he exhibited had its roots in Jackie's story, because he too was a man of faith, Jackie Robinson. People don't know this. If they caught 42, the movie, there's barely a mention of it. And by the way, that's a recurring theme here on this show, that so many of the men and women we admire in this country did the remarkable things they did because of their faith. And yet, the mainstream media tends to secularize these people and turn them into just, well, ordinary folks who did things because they just did them. We know that wasn't the case with Martin Luther King, and we certainly know that wasn't the case with Jackie Robinson. It was stripped out of the movie. We're putting it right back where it belongs, on center stage, here on Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, joined by Pat Williams, author of How to Be Like Jackie Robinson. More about this great American hero when we come back. This is Our American Stories, and we're talking with Pat Williams, whose book, How to Be Like Jackie Robinson, is a favorite here on the show. He's also the co-founder and senior vice president of the Orlando Magic, and has written over 80 books on leadership. And Pat, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Lee. Good to be with you.
You bet. Hey, look, we wanted to go to a little transition here and talk about Branch Rickey, because I think Jackie couldn't have done what he'd done without the courageous leadership of Branch. Harrison Ford played him in 42, and I wanted to play a clip for you of Harrison talking about what it was like to play such a great man.
Branch Rickey was a man who had a very strong religious conviction, a great moral conviction. that not only would it be important for baseball, but would be very important for America. And he'd had personal experience with racism in baseball and in life, and felt, you know, at this time, at the period of time we're talking about, there was no basketball, there was no football. Baseball was America, and America was baseball. So what happened in baseball had a huge influence over the culture. And I think if what he did in baseball hadn't happened, it would have taken another 15 years for the civil rights movement to really achieve the results that they had.
Talk about Branch, if you can. Your book was a bit about him. It was almost a co-biography in a sense, wasn't it?
Well, the two of them are linked forever and will be linked forever. Mr. Rickey was running the Brooklyn Club, and let's face it, he wanted to win, and he wanted to sell tickets, and he knew that there was this league, the Negro Leagues, and he knew there was talent in there. But up till then, there had been an unwritten agreement that major league teams wouldn't sign any of them. So Mr. Rickey wanted to get a jump on his opponents, on his competitors. And so he sent scouts into the old Negro Leagues, and he began looking around at these ball players. He knew it would take a special athlete and a special person to be the first. So his scouts went in and combed through those leagues and came back and reported to Mr. Rickey that they thought Jackie Robinson would be the best one to go with. He had played in integrated situations at UCLA and other sports and baseball too. And he had been in the military. He was a little bit older. He was married to an outstanding woman. I mean, all the things that Rickey thought were important. So that set up the famous meeting where Rickey brought Robinson into Brooklyn. And that movie, by the way, captured it so well. I thought Harrison.
You know, Pat, we have that clip. Pat, we have that clip. So why don't we play it for our audience right now?
Yeah, let's listen to that.
You want a player who doesn't have the guts to fight back?
No, I want a player who's got the guts not to fight back.
You know, in that scene, Rickey really then lays into Jackie, giving him some of the heckling that he'll hear most certainly. And by the way, not just in the, quote, racist South. I mean, this was New York he was going to hear it, and Chicago. It wasn't like most of the country didn't have pockets of racism. The whole country was racist. Only in the South was there legal segregation. Talk a bit about that, Pat.
Well, Rickey pretended to be, a leather-lunged fan, you know, riding Robinson. And he pretended to be a hotel clerk. Pretended to be a number of different people acting out, you know, in raw language, you know, what Robinson would be facing. And he knew that if Jackie reacted and if Jackie fought back, this whole experiment would be set back 10 or 15 years.
And,
he needed a ball player who could play and who could help the Dodgers win. And along with it, for 2 years in the big leagues, Rickey made him promise that he would not react, he would not fight back.
Well, you know, we had a chance, Pat, to talk to the author of Bonhoeffer, Eric Metaxas, who wrote a book about seven great men in American history whose faith made them who they are, but who no one knew about. I wanted you to play, Pat, I wanted to play for you a clip we got from Eric earlier today.
Good.
Knowing that Jackie shared his Christian faith and wanting to reinforce the spiritual dimensions of what the two men were about to embark upon, Rickey brought out a copy of a book titled Life of Christ by Giovanni Papini. He flipped to the passage in which Papini discusses the Sermon on the Mount and refers to it as the most stupefying of Jesus's revolutionary teachings. It certainly was revolutionary. In fact, it seemed impossible. In Matthew 5:38 through 41, Jesus said, "Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, that ye resist not evil. But whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law, and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. and whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain.
Pat, Jackie would have to turn his cheek a heck of a lot. What were some of those awful moments? And bring them to life for our audience, if you could.
Well, I think the most famous one was led by the manager of the Philadelphia Phillies, Ben Chapman, from Birmingham, Alabama. And he started riding Robinson immediately in April of 1947 when the Phillies and the Dodgers hooked up for the first time. And he insisted that all of the players in the dugout do the same. Get on Robinson verbally, and whatever they wanted to say, you know, let it rip. And Chapman all but ordered those players to do it. And so you had this this wave of comments and put-downs, you know, and ugly language coming out of the Phillies dugout. And Robinson later in his life said, you know, he was angry, and he said, I wanted to so badly go over and rip Chapman. He said, I almost didn't care what Ricky had made me say or promise. But he held his temper. And, you know, and later, when the Phillies were hosting the Dodgers, the Phillies were embarrassed. They wanted to try and clean this up. So they asked Robinson to pose with Chapman, and something he really didn't want to do, but he did. And there's that famous picture in Philadelphia of Robinson and Chapman standing together and, you know, trying to quiet the whole thing down. And the Phillies eventually fired Chapman and, you know, never to return to baseball.
You know, Pat, we've got that clip, too, from 42. Jesse, hit it.
Hey, Pee-wee, what's this doing for you all that you let him drink out of the same water fountain as you? I hope you don't take showers with him. Is he gonna be a mess? Hey, you like white women? Huh? Hey, which one of these Dodger wives are you climbing on tonight? Time!
Ugly, Pat. Really ugly. I also wanted to play you, though, Rachel Robinson, who talked about Jackie's perseverance and steadfastness through all this. Here's Rachel. Here's
he felt disappointed at times, frustrated, disillusioned, down, but he would pick himself up. He's very resilient and very determined, you know, really stubborn about the thing. He was going to make it work.
So there was obviously God in his life. His wife, what role did she play in all this, Pat?
Well, Rachel Robinson's one of the most impressive women I've ever met. She's still living in her 90s, a beautiful lady, sharp, intelligent, just a real hero of anybody that follows baseball. And Jackie never could have done this without her. She was a support to him. She was an encourager. She was just a marvelous partner and has carried on, you know, running the Jackie Robinson Foundation, which provides scholarships for minority students and has helped educate well over 1,000 students over the years. So Rachel's one of the really, really important people in this story. I'm a huge admirer of Rachel Robinson.
We're talking with Pat Williams, author of How to Be Like Jackie Robinson. Again, he's written over 80 books on leadership on just about everybody who matters in American life. He's also the co-founder and senior VP of the Orlando Magic. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. You can hear all of this at OurAmericanNetwork.org. That's OurAmericanNetwork.org. When we come back, more with Pat and more on the life of Jackie Robinson. This is Our American Stories, and we're talking with Pat Williams about the life of Jackie Robinson. You know, one of the things Jackie Robinson had to face in his life, as Pat wrote so well about, was the pressure to perform. It wasn't just that he had to deal with all this onslaught of taunts and racial epithets. He had to get on that field and hit and play. And Pat, in his book, had written this. He wrote, and this was Roy Campanella, his buddy, speaking, "Maybe it's just not enough for us to make out okay. You see, so many people are counting on us, not only Negroes, but so many white people, too, who believe in equal opportunity. It's like we're speaking for all of them by how we play on the field. We do it by playing such outstanding ball that there's no question left in anyone's mind about whether or not Negroes have a contribution to make to big league ball." I mean, can you imagine that? Having to step up to the plate representing a race and representing an idea called equality? It's just, it's extraordinary. And when we get Pat back on the line, we'll ask him about that. But earlier today, we interviewed Mark Reese, son of the Dodger great Pee Wee Reese. And Mark told us something I'd never heard about. Those first couple of games that Jackie was in the big leagues, when the pressure was greatest on him.
You got to remember, Jackie was, he started out, I think he went 0 for 12 or 0 for 14 or something like that at the beginning of the season. He wasn't really showing his abilities.
So Jackie starts out the year, his first year, 0 for 12 or 0 for 14. Pee-wee's son couldn't remember precisely. But either way, imagine starting off that way. What happens? Where do you go? In Pat's book, he actually talks with Keith Olbermann, who commented on what would have happened if Jackie wasn't able to carry, well, just any of his weight. I mean, what would have happened if he had batted 250? And here's what Olbermann said. He said, "Sports is a societal testing ground in this country. And as time goes on, we realize how important that 1947 really was. Jackie ended up hitting 297, but if he'd hit 197 and been released in July, then the critics could have claimed that no black man could stand the pressure of Major League Baseball. If Jackie had failed, when could the next black man have received another chance? What would have happened to this country in this whole area of integration? It boggles the mind to think of this nation if Jackie had stumbled and if he'd fallen." Well, Dodgers owner Branch Rickey's courage, and we have to deal with the courage that allowed Jackie to do what he did, because again, it wasn't just Jackie's courage, it was Rickey's. Jackie's courage and Rickey's were contagious for each other. And also folks like Commissioner Happy Chandler, because as you can imagine, the baseball commissioner had a lot on his plate. Can you imagine some of the things he was hearing from some of the owners? Some fans were protesting and picketing and boycotting. Wherever Jackie Robinson played, they weren't going to show up. Some sponsors were starting to dig in. After baseball's owners voted 15-1 against letting Robinson play in the major leagues, Rickey visited Chandler and asked him where he stood on the prospect of having Robinson play. Here's Steven Goldberg, a lifelong Dodger fan and former chairman of City University of New York Sociology Department, telling the story of Chandler's response.
The best guy was Happy Chandler, who was the chairman of baseball. And Happy Chandler looked like the perfect image of a fat sheriff who had black dogs that ate black people. In fact, a lot of the people who were hoping Jackie wouldn't be able to play said, look at Happy Chandler. What kind of chances are there going to be that he's going to let a black player play? And when it came time to make the announcement of what he was going to do, Happy Chandler said, "I was in that atoll, like an island in the Pacific. This was World War II. He says, "I looked around. There were red guys. There were black guys. They were all fighting for freedom. And it strikes me that if my day comes and I got to go, and God says, how come you didn't let Robinson play ball? I'm going to have to say, it was his color." And I just had this feeling God wasn't going to like that answer.
"I have a feeling God's not going to like that answer," said Happy Chandler. Pat, talk about Happy Chandler and the influence of his leadership in Major League Baseball.
He, listen,
he was an important part of this story. He was the successor to Judge Landis, who, from every report we get, was racist and, in his own way, kept the major leagues purely white. And so the sense was Chandler probably would continue that way. U.S. Senator from Kentucky, and but nevertheless, Ricky went to Chandler, explained to him what he was about to do, and he got Chandler's support. We heard that quote just before, that what Chandler's feelings were, that he was going to have to face his God one day, and he did not want to be the one who said, you know, I kept a black man out of Major League Baseball. So Ricky got support from the commissioner's office, and that was an important detail that allowed this story to come to a head and come to fruition.
You know, and because courage is so contagious, Pat, it even spilled down to young boys and girls across the country. In your book, we meet the same Steve Goldberg we'd heard before. When he was a young boy, he said he was a lonely child and felt that he could identify on some small scale with Robinson, who was courageous enough to stand alone.
The wonderful thing in imagining, he said, is in so imagining, you become a little more like the person, a little more to be sure, but even this little bit matters. As Jackie has been gone a long time now, and we miss him terribly, but he's here every time we have to be reminded that courage is necessary, courage is possible.
So imagine that, Patty. He didn't just have an influence on African Americans. A lonely Jewish kid living in New York City felt the same thing that a lot of African Americans were feeling. Talk about his influence on white people, Pat.
Well, let me tell you about another Jewish kid from Brooklyn. His name was Harris Rosen, who grew up in Brooklyn. He's now a very successful hotelier here in Central Florida, in Orlando, and a good friend of mine. But Harris has told me this story. He said he was having some trouble with his legs as a kid, and he went into the doctor's office, and the doctor asked Harry, young Harris, to walk across the room for him. And then he said to Harris's mother, I'm seeing a lot of youngsters with this same problem. Well, the problem was Jackie Robinson, their hero, walked in a pigeon-toed fashion. And so these youngsters were doing the same thing, and in the process were doing damage to their legs. And so Harris to this day tells that wonderful story that when he finally began to walk normally and not pigeon-toed, his legs came responded. But the doctor said to Mrs. Rosen, I'm seeing a lot of young people in here with the same problem.
How to Be Like Jackie Robinson. That's Pat's book. Order it online at Amazon.com. By the way, order anything that he's written, Pat Williams, that is, especially How to Be Like Walt. We did a two-hour segment on Walt Disney, one of the only 2 hours we've done here on this show, because the life commanded it. It commanded it, as did Martin Luther King's. And when we come back, we're going to talk about something you don't hear much of from society, and that word is the word class. One thing that Jackie Robinson had plenty of. And you're going to hear about it in ways, again, that you've never heard about before from anyone telling his story. This is Lee Habib. And this is Our American Stories. We'll be back after these messages. This is Our American Stories, and today we're celebrating the life of Jackie Robinson for the hour with Pat Williams. One of the most common things people who knew Jackie Robinson said about him is what a gentleman he was and the incredible amount of class he possessed. Jackie entering an opposing clubhouse to offer congratulations was not an unusual occurrence. Pat, you write about him doing so even after losing the deciding game of the World Series in 1952 and how much it meant to one player. Talk about that.
Well, that's a great story, Lee. He goes in there, the Yankees beat the Dodgers, and after the final game, he goes into the clubhouse of the Yankees to congratulate them, and he seeks out a very young Mickey Mantle. And he commented to Mickey how much he admired him and thought he had a great future and had some very, very kind words for a very young Mickey Mantle who was at the very start of his career. And Mickey would say later what that meant to him. He said, first of all, you know, after losing a World Series, I'm not sure I could have gone into the other clubhouse. But for those words to be said by Jackie to Mickey was a huge part of his growing up as a major league ball player. He never forgot those words. And Lee, there was one other example, and I know this firsthand because Robin Roberts, the great Phillies pitcher who was a good friend, told me that after the season ended, the regular season, with the Phillies beating the Dodgers in the 10th inning of a very, very dramatic game at Ebbets Field, Jackie Robinson, after this heartbreaking loss, came over into the Phillies clubhouse to wish them well. And Robin Roberts said to me, you know, I'm not sure I could have done something like that after a tough loss. But he said Jackie was there to do it.
You know, his class was so moving that it even had the power to change hearts. In our conversation earlier today, Pat, with Mark Reese, the son of Dodger shortstop Pee Wee Reese, he told us about his dad's initial reaction to Jackie joining his team. Play it, Jesse.
There was a serious maturation that my father needed. At that time, my father had just come home from war, from World War II. He'd lost three seasons to World War II. Someone shouted at him, said, hey, Pee-wee, just heard over the wire that the Dodgers had signed a shortstop. And my dad's first reaction was, so? You know, they're always signing shortstops or something from the minor leagues. He said, well, not only is he a shortstop, but he is a N-word. My father's reaction then was, what am I going home to?
Let's talk about Pee-wee Reese's heart, because, well, in the end, Pee-wee Reese wasn't that much different than a lot of folks in America. The people he knew, and perhaps even himself, didn't much like black people. Talk about that, Pat.
Well, he grew up in southern Kentucky, in Louisville, and, you know, a very highly segregated area, and for him to be playing with a black player back home, oh my goodness, the people back home, you know, were appalled or would have been appalled. But yet it was Pee-wee who went out of his way to defuse a number of racial situations. And the most famous one was in Cincinnati when the fans were all over Jackie and just riding him. And Pee-wee, very close to his hometown of Louisville, walked over and put his arm around Jackie and to silence the critics. There's a wonderful statue outside the ballpark, the minor league ballpark, right there near Coney Island, and the Mets play there. But there's this wonderful statue of Pee-wee and Jackie standing together, you know, way, way back on the field. It's just a reenactment with that statue of Pee-wee reaching out to Jackie.
You know, we've got a scene from that movie, the climactic moment when Pee-wee turned a page in front of all of his friends and family. The Dodgers were playing in Cincinnati, as you said, Pat, and although some say it may not have happened or it happened in another city, when the opposing team's fans were booing Robinson boisterously, and Pee-wee decided to put his arm around Jackie in one of the most, well, epic scenes of solidarity. Here's that scene as depicted in the movie 42.
I think say all they want. We're just here to play ball.
It's just a bunch of crackpots still fighting the Civil War.
Well, hell, we'd have won that son of a gun if the cornstalks would have held out. We just ran out of ammunition.
Better luck next time, Pee-wee.
Ain't gonna be a next time, Jackie.
All we got's right here.
Thank you, Jackie.
What are you thanking me for?
I got family up there from Louisville. I need them to know. I need them to know who I am.
Hey, number one! You playing ball or socializing?
Playing ball, Unc. Come
on!
Playing ball. Maybe tomorrow we'll all wear 42. That way they won't tell us apart.
Maybe tomorrow we'll all wear 42. That way they won't tell us apart. Talk about that, Pat, if you could. The way racial lines were just eliminated by Jackie.
Yeah, and Pee Wee was such a big part of that. And what a classy gentleman he was. I had a real treat one day way back. I was we were actually in the playoffs in Indianapolis, and I had a free day, and I wanted to meet Pee Wee Reese and get him to sign a picture for me. And he gave me the directions to his home in Louisville. He was standing outside his house, you know, to help wave me in, and ushered me up into his place. And he and his wife Dottie were there. I spent about an hour with him. Never will forget that day. And there was nobody classier than Pee Wee Reese. So anything that Jackie accomplished, he would tell you that Pee Wee Reese was a huge part of it.
You know, Pat, talk about Red Barber, the very famous sportscaster and basic personality, one of the great personalities in radio broadcasting. Talk about that story in your book before Game 2 of the 1972 World Series, Pat, if you could.
Well, there was this situation where Jackie was dying, really, and you know, he wasn't going to live much longer. And of course, Red Barber had traveled with him and got to know Jackie. But I think the key Red Barber story, Lee, is at the very, very beginning of this. Here you have Red Barber, a native of the South, and you know, who had grown up in segregated societies, and Mr. Rickey knew that he needed Red Barber on his side, you know, to make this thing work. And so he pulled Barber aside. He was one of the very first people who knew about it and explained to Red Barber what he was going to do. Barber was appalled. Barber didn't fully understand it, but he wrote later and talked about it very openly about, you know, how privileged he felt that Rickey shared that with him. And he was sold, and he became a huge supporter of what Rickey was doing.
We got a clip of Mark Reese on Jackie's headstone.
Well, Pee Wee always said that Jackie did more for him than he ever did for Jackie. And Jackie's buried in Cypress Hill Cemetery in New York City. And on his headstone, there's a favorite quote of Jackie's that reads, a life is not important except in the impact it has on other lives. And it's safe to say Jackie Robinson has had an impact on tens of millions of people around the world. And I like to think we're all better for it.
You know, Pat, I think he's still impacting lives. And tonight, anyone within earreach of this is having their lives impacted as well. I know I am. I've practically teared up a couple of times. I've learned some things. Alex has done such a great job, and Jesse, of putting this all together. Pat, the impact he had on you and preparing this, what did it do to you?
Well, as I put that book together, I'll tell you this, you know, with the interviews I did, and then when we wrote it, and then I kept proofing it, there were numbers of times when I would just stop reading because I, you know, I couldn't go on. There was a big lump in my throat, and my eyes were watering up, and the thought that I had was, Jackie, how did you ever put up with this? Jackie was a proud guy, bitterly competitive, wanted to win, and he just had to do things that no human being should be asked to do, namely bite your lip, turn your cheek, and ignore it all and just play ball. Fortunately, he was able to do that. And the whole experience of Mr. Rickey's, by the way, Lee, could have been absolutely doomed if, for example, one night Jackie lost it. Let's say he's in St. Louis, and he just lost it and went up into the stands with a bat, you know, and just started to wave that bat You know, think about that. The entire experiment would have been sabotaged and set back 10 or 12 years. But Robinson had the ability, under fire, to do what Ricky wanted. And the end result was, well, Willie Mays came along, and Henry Aaron came along, and Frank Robinson came along, and, you know, none of those guys, we wouldn't have heard from any of those guys if Robinson had not done what he did.
Well, Pat, thanks so much for the time tonight, and thanks for writing this book, How to Be Like Jackie Robinson. Get it, order it. Pat, thanks so much again.
Lee, good to talk to you. Thanks a million.
You bet. And once again, How to Be Like Jackie Robinson. That's Pat's book. He's co-founder and senior VP of the Orlando Magic. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, the life of Jackie Robinson.